A warm welcome to another live session at WideMoat Investing Summit 2019. It's a great pleasure to introduce our next instructor based in New York. Elliot Turner is a co-founder and managing director at RGA Investment Advisors. RGA runs a long-term, low-turnover GARP strategy seeking out global opportunities. Before RGA, Elliot managed portfolios at Austin Weston Asset Management, Chimera Securities, and T3 Capital. He holds a BA from Emory University, where he double majored in political science and philosophy, as well as a JD from Brooklyn Law School. As many of you will know and certainly appreciate, Elliot has shared his wisdom and ideas with our members in the past. Perhaps my favorite was Elliot's presentation on Twitter at WideMoat Investing Summit 2017, when Twitter traded at an enterprise value of only about $10 billion. Perhaps more notably, Elliot's presentation this past January has been playing out probably faster than he has expected or anyone would have expected, particular his idea, Roku. I encourage all of you to go back and revisit that and just see the thought process behind that idea, because I think it is playing out for the right reasons as well. So we are truly grateful that Elliot has chosen this opportunity to be with us again. Without further ado, a very warm welcome. And Elliot, I'm going to turn it to you.
Thank you so much, John. Thank you for having me again. I love these conferences, get great ideas from all of you. I get outstanding feedback, really struck a chord with my last presentation on Roku and PayPal. Got so much great feedback from all of you listening that helped sharpen my own ideas. And I, you know, really connected with a bunch of you. And so, and I'm sure some of you know who I'm speaking to, that we've been speaking ever since. So it's been pretty cool, pretty exciting. Happy to be here again. Today I'm going to be presenting on Grubhub. I tend to like these controversial, call them tech names, but it's all about Grubhub today. And John mentioned Twitter in 2017. That spring, I had been contemplating whether to present Twitter or Grubhub, but Grubhub had a good run heading into that period, so it wasn't quite as cheap. You know, we're GARP investors, so I very much focus on valuation as well. And I felt I missed it, but I'll get to that in a second. So these are the disclaimers. We do own shares in Grubhub, you know, may sell them at our choice, but you know, we tend to be long-term oriented. So to give a sense of our long-term orientation, when this presentation is done, I will have presented 8 ideas at Manual of Ideas conferences since 2015. We now cross the threshold where more than half of our portfolio will have been presented. And of all those ideas, haven't sold a single share of those 8 ideas. In fact, own more of most of them than at the time of the presentation. There was one idea that I presented before that, back in 2013. And maybe that might have to be my next presentation, as I run out of new blood from the portfolio to get and hunt here, about like a great lesson, one that didn't quite go as well. So yeah, maybe that's something that I'll have to consider. So before I get into my deep dive on Grubhub, I wanted to start and introduce something conceptual. I like thinking in terms of mental models and the portability of them from one domain or discipline to another. Charlie Munger tells us to apply the big ideas from mathematics, physics, chemistry, whatever it may be. But I'm going to tell you about a really powerful big idea from fantasy baseball. Not quite physics or chemistry, but I think there's some interesting concepts that we could learn from fantasy baseball. In a lot of respects, baseball, especially fantasy baseball, is similar to investing. Think of your team as a portfolio. Your players are your equities. Everyone has the same resources to analyze a growing trove of data. There are, however, constant inefficiencies for managers to discover. My favorite setup in fantasy baseball happens to be the post-hype sleeper. And it's well illustrated by Javi Baez, who, just like Grubhub, is based in Chicago. Baez was called up by the Cubs in 2014 to much hype as a consensus top 10 prospect. Just about everywhere you looked, he was the guy to go after. But Baez really struggled in his first stint in the big leagues. In fact, he was a below average player. It took him 2 years to start getting regular at bats, and at that point, it was as a utility man. From there, it took another 2 years to become an MVP caliber player. But in the intervening period, all the hype was gone, and Baez could be drafted in late rounds or in auctions for dirt cheap prices. It's kind of what we're looking for in the market. So let's translate the post-hype sleeper setup from fantasy baseball to the market. Often it comes in the form of a busted IPO, but it doesn't have to be a recent issue. There's a momentum in the stock and rich valuation metrics, positive fundamental momentum along the way, growing intrinsic value through key growth KPIs slowdown, which leads the stock price to break down sharply. Downside momentum overshoots, though the business keeps growing in intrinsic value all the while. The stock's not necessarily cheap enough for traditional value, and growth investors are too recently burnt to come back. That's where GARP really comes in. You'll often hear something like, I love the company and I'd buy this stock higher if numbers reaccelerate, or lower if things stay the same, but not right here. It's a quote I hear a lot from different kinds of investors. And then what happens is the stock settles into a range of apathy. So let's see what this looks like in visual form. First, we'll take a look at the bust period. This is Grubhub stock from IPO to January 2016. The IPO priced at $26 and opened at $40. So, you know, a lot of recent hot new IPOs, people are saying this is indicative of the top, whatever it may be. But, you know, these first day pops are a pretty common phenomenon. Grubhub traded up from there before collapsing and shedding 2/3 of its value. Hey, we might have our new crop of future post-type sleepers. Grubhub spent almost half a year building a base and then blasted off after that first decline. We started our position while it was chopping around in this busted phase. But while it had a great run after recovering, the path was hardly linear. There are two individual days alone where the stock dropped 15% from Amazon headlines that broke out Amazon's ambitions in the delivery space. There are four individual days where the stock dropped 15% along the way. So I think the lesson here is that the path to greatness simply is not linear. I'd first intended to present Grubhub in the spring of 2016 at the Wide Mode Investing Summit, and again in the spring of 2017, the time I presented on Twitter. And in 2016, I actually presented on InvestNet. I still like both those ideas today, but that's a digression. Each time I was planning on presenting Grubhub, the stock ran up heading into the conference stage, so I had to pick something else. Maybe if John invited me to present in the 2017 Best Ideas Conference, I would have had my chance. That was really a good GARP buy, but let today serve as proof that there's always another chance. And I mean that both in terms of finding something to present on, but as long-term investors. I might have been out of ideas already had I come to this conference having presented Grubhub in 2017, considering how much of our book has been presented that we still own. So it's kind of interesting to think about it along those ways. This year at Best Ideas, I already had to go back to the well with PayPal. And while I'm mentioning PayPal, I love thinking about portfolio synergies. So one of my favorite things to do is ordering a Grubhub meal while checking out with PayPal's one-touch solution. Each of my companies gets to earn a little margin on my behavior, and I did exactly that for lunch today, preparing for my presentation. So I'm really big on the idea that there's always another chance, I've said this already, which gets to the heart of my philosophy on position management. I spoke about this at the MOI Global Ideal Week conference in St. Moritz, which was an awesome experience, met some great people. So I hope some of you are out there listening right now. I did this presentation to raise questions, but I want to highlight a couple of key concepts that I look at myself. I like this idea of imposed patience. With a long time frame, we have the luxury of never saying, I missed it. After all, every investment is actually a hypothesis that we're testing along the way, based on a decision made in an uncertain world. We get new information every day, and we have to weight that information against what we already know. As a result, I never buy my full position size on day one. And given this idea that every investment is a hypothesis, the most important thing to know is when you're right and when you're wrong. We want to find those opportunities where Soros says something like, go for the jugular. Personally, you can get far greater conviction in something I know well, something I've seen move in the market, than something newly entering the book. One big reason behind that is, in a complex world, the longer you're involved in something, the more you can simplify a thesis. And if you get to that point where you simplify a complex thesis to just one variable, you've got something pretty special. And we'll get to that in this case on the fulcrum slide about Grubhub. So now for the idea itself. I want to start the story with the merger of Grubhub and Seamless. The merger combined two early competitors, creating a two-sided marketplace in the delivery space. With the merger, the competition between the two became an afterthought, and they're able to consolidate their presence, expand to new geographies, and focus intently on increasing the depth on both sides of the marketplace. So in terms of diners and restaurants. So I'm calling this the pure marketplace, and you'll understand why in a little bit. But in the beginning, this is the flow for how online delivery orders worked. Very early on, Grubhub would take a 12% take rate for matching diners with restaurants. Demand was highly incremental for restaurants and helped push the range of delivery offerings beyond genres like pizza and Chinese food, which we were all familiar with as the core offerings in a given geography. Take a moment to note the facts part in the middle. In the early days, all the restaurants were mom and pops, no chains, and fax was the way they received their orders. Grubhub made it so easy and frictionless for diners that the site, and let's remember this is before the iPhone and the app itself really took off, that diners started commencing their search and discovery within Grubhub instead of Google or anywhere else. This happened because Grubhub removed two crucial pain points for diners. First, most people had kept a drawer in their kitchen for the menus from a few delivery options in the area. Grubhub gave you a centralized place to know exactly which restaurants delivered to your address and what was on the menu. Second, calling in an order was prone to error in high-volume restaurants. With a neatly printed order sheet, the risk of error went way down. In the prior slide, I pointed out the early days of Grub boasted a 12% take rate, and back then, some loud observers were calling the take rate way too high. But core marketplace take rate had lifted over time to above 15%. This is because the company has become the starting point for diner search and discovery. So there is a really large addressable market. And that's one thing I consistently look for. To break down the addressable market, we started with the total spend on food away from home, which is about $250 billion. $70 billion of that pie goes towards takeaway and delivery. $30 billion of that takeaway and delivery slice already goes on digital platforms, including Grubhub, DoorDash, Uber Eats, Postmates, etc. And its competitors, and the pizza companies like Domino's, who are already pretty advanced in digital ordering. The picture on the right shows food at home versus food away from home using CPI data. And that's where the $250 billion TAM comes from. It's about 270 today, so it's a little bigger, but you get the picture. For the longest time, food at home and food away from home ran in lockstep. But about 10 years ago, they started diverging from one another, with food away from home taking the lead. And in the last 5 years, food away's lead has meaningfully accelerated. So something is very different now. And what you have effectively is a growing TAM. Delivery is becoming increasingly popular, and a lot of that is due to the success of Grubhub in removing the frictions of ordering. Demographics play a big role in this too. The habits of young and old are diverging meaningfully. Millennials have very different experiences and expectations for where and how to eat. In fact, the youngest cohort of millennials have grown up with online food ordering to the point where it's basically second nature. And you can see that pretty clearly in the chart on the right here. Food away from home for millennials is much more important than any other cohort. So one thing I'd point out is that success has its downside. As well as things have gone overall for Grubhub, it hasn't always been easy. At the time of IPO, Grubhub was trying to get restaurants to move from the fax-based order flow we referenced before to a tablet. And there was some strong pushback. Stock had a rough day when that was a headline for a little bit. Worse yet, Grubhub has made some enemies in the restaurant base, especially amongst restaurants who already had robust delivery businesses to start with. It was hard for these restaurants to stomach a 15% take rate on what they perceived as their own organic demand. Fact is, people just like ordering online so much. One restaurant was quoted in the Tribeca Citizen saying, "If I stop using them, tomorrow I close the door." On the one hand, there's no better summary in one line of the moat of Grubhub. They literally are the source of demand for the restaurant. On the other hand, a restaurant like that fears how much of their own destiny is no longer in their own hands. 90% of independent restaurants close within the first year, and the survivors average a five-year lifespan. It's a cutthroat industry. It's hard to parse out exactly to what extent Grubhub is merely a scapegoat for the inevitable failures or a rightful target of scorn for taking a big slice of margin in such a low-margin business. More recently, there's been controversy about Grubhub's system of protecting against those who work around the online order flow by calling in orders. The New York Post has really been hammering away at the story, and you can see a litany of headlines here. The company had systematized a charge at restaurants based on the average order value for phone calls over a certain length. Grubhub has settled with some restaurants, but even larger settlements don't amount to too much dollar value. So, I mean, I'm not too concerned about this risk, but it seems like more an anger finding a channel for outlash than true investment risk. And restaurants really do love Grubhub. Plenty of restaurants, in fact, have built their businesses on it. Before Grubhub came around, the only game in town for delivery in most cities was pizza or Chinese food. Grubhub has empowered just about every cuisine with an opportunity to participate in this important and growing market. Many restaurants advertise, so they were spending money on accessing customers anyway, and Grubhub is viewed by many as just another advertising channel. But it's not just any advertising channel, because the best part is that the restaurant only pays out of this budget if an order is actually made. This helps solve the ROI and attribution problem for ad spend. A really important point is that restaurants will attest to the high incrementality of orders from Grubhub, both in terms of the actual diners they reach, in other words, new diners who wouldn't have actually ordered before, and in terms of the average order value. AOVs tend to be higher for the typical restaurant in the delivery channel than they do elsewhere. Then it's important that phone orders are a messy process where mistakes can get made. Mistakes frustrate diners and have to be corrected at the restaurant's expense. So there's a cost on both sides, because you need a person dedicated to answering the phone, and a restaurant needs to foot the bill for fixing a mistake. Digitizing order flow drastically reduces the error rate. And fundamentally, diners want to order how they want to order, and whether restaurants like it or not, they need to facilitate that reality. Seth Priebatsch, the founder of Level Up and now a key figure at Grubhub, calls this the Faustian bargain. And last, delivery orders and takeaway have minimal front of house costs, and so there's some margin offset to balance the cost of that take rate. So we've been talking mainly about the marketplace business, because that's where all this began. But now Grubhub has another side to the business, and it's delivery. This is where we get into why Grubhub had that first post-hype sleeper phase. What happened is that when Grubhub got into the delivery business in late 2015 by acquiring three regional delivery services, there was a lot of negativity from the investor base. And this negativity was amplified when CEO Matt Maloney was quoted calling delivery itself a shitty business. But there was a method to the madness and a degree of misinterpretation. But Maloney had a point. There's little to no margin to be made in delivery itself. While pure marketplace orders are a two-sided marketplace, delivery is a three-sided marketplace where diners connect with restaurants for orders, and the delivery itself is handled by a driver. So that's even harder to pull off from a technological and a logistics perspective. That's an important point there. The marketplace take rate is about 15%, while delivery is 30% with a $2 delivery fee on top. So those are the two channels. The key that Maloney was getting at in calling it a shitty business is how delivery itself is merely a means to two specific ends. More restaurants in the restaurant side of the network. So there are a lot of restaurants who didn't want to hire staff to do delivery themselves. This gave them a way to get into that without actually doing so. And the second one is more total orders from hungry diners. So the more opportunity there is to order, the more orders there will be. The key for the company became fitting the cost of delivery orders into the take rate that goes above and beyond the pure marketplace take rate. So think of the take rate on delivery orders as having two components or parts to it. 15% for generating demand and 15% to cover the cost of delivering an order. Since orders on marketplace and delivery carry very different margin profiles, Grubhub introduced the concept of economic parity for investors to follow progress. What the company means when they mention economic parity is that inevitably, if the cost of delivery is covered perfectly in that 15% piece of the total 30% pie, then the EBITDA per order should be the same between delivery and marketplace orders. This would leave every stakeholder in the platform agnostic to whether an order comes via the marketplace or delivery side of things. One important point to add here is that management has made a commitment to diners that any efficiencies on the delivery side, which would conceivably result in margin on the 15% piece, would be given back in the form of lower fees. This is how Grubhub shows the profit and margin for the two kinds of orders. So you can see pretty clearly that Grubhub has a much better margin on marketplace, which they call self-delivery here, than they do on Grubhub delivery. But the profit pool is the same, right? Grubhub's profit per order in both cases is $3.40 based on this $30 average order size. A lot of investors focus intently on margins, and purely on that basis, delivery then looks like a worse business. But in reality, the objective at Grubhub is to create orders, and in that sense, the amount of gross food sales and the EBITDA they generate is far more important to figuring out what this is worth long term. This will be important when we talk about valuation and look at EBITDA to GFS. So now let's talk about making that shitty business yummy. Think of the late 2015 period through the end of 2017 as the first wave of Grubhub's push into turnkey delivery. The company achieved economic parity and the stock blasted off after getting comfortable with the transformed business model. This success built management's confidence in the company's ability to roll out new delivery markets and bring them to scale. They learned a lot of lessons along the way and wanted to take advantage of that. As a result, management decided to get even more aggressive. This came in the form of a partnership with Yum Brands that came with Yum taking a $200 million equity stake. The partnership and proceeds from the Yum stake were intended to help Grubhub support the cost of expanding massively beyond their existing markets into new Tier 2 and Tier 3 cities. Big chains come along with great customer awareness and volume. This would help introduce the Grubhub brand to new diners. Yum explicitly agreed to support this in its own marketing, and they did a great ad with the Taco Bell launch on Grubhub's platform, where Grubhub didn't pay a dollar for the actual ad, but they played a prominent role. And this goes above and beyond the organic awareness that being the go-to platform for these actual chains creates. So Grubhub would be able to leverage Yum's strong brands as a toehold in each new market launch. Effectively, Yum would provide a path to acquiring diners at a lower cost for Grubhub and drive order volume in order to ensure that the third side of this three-sided delivery marketplace, the drivers, would have enough work in order to be efficient. So further rollout into new Tier 2 and Tier 3 cities, Grubhub was spending an incremental $40 million in operations and support that was a real drag in margins for this year. And we'll get to that in a couple. So for Yum, the partnership was the best way to get into delivery. They did a lot of research in advance, and this was the path they chose. It was cheaper and more efficient than building their own network. It came with provably high order incrementality, which even after rollout, they're citing has been quite impressive. It's a meaningful point for all restaurants who go on Grubhub, and I think Yum's good proof that this is the case. And it would tap into a new source of demand in the form of Grubhub's nearly 20 million active diners. With Grubhub, Yum would get shared data on the end customer, something other platforms were not offering, and Yum would have the opportunity to treat each of its brands as necessary. So for example, Pizza Hut would enter only on the pure marketplace side, while KFC and Taco Bell would take advantage of Grub's delivery offering. This wouldn't be an option with competitors like DoorDash or Uber Eats. Yum would also receive another benefit, which has become a third pillar of Grubhub's strategy. Shortly after the Yum deal, Grubhub bought LevelUp and brought its founder, Seth Priebatsch, into a key role as its head of enterprise sales. Grubhub, in the process, became a fully integrated technology partner who builds the website and app for restaurants, including two of the Yum brands. Furthermore, while the marketplace had always handled takeaway, LevelUp made it clear that Grubhub's essence, their reason for being, is to digitize order flow, not just facilitate delivery orders. This is important both in terms of how the product is built and how Grubhub differentiates its offering from competitors on the restaurant side of things. With LevelUp's technology and a focus on digitizing orders, Grubhub would be able to help restaurants build out their own digital presence, and Grubhub could integrate restaurant reward programs into their platform and manage how it's treated across channels. I strongly recommend that anyone with even modest interest in the space watch the link to Seth Priebatsch's talk at ICR in 2018 on solving the digital channel dilemma. I have an embedded quote here from Seth's blog post that accompanied that presentation. And he gives some great context on how restaurants could use rewards and the data that comes with cross-channel and the advantages that come with full data and analytics on cross-channel awareness. So it's really helpful, really important, and I think it's the future of the space, really. So while the company doesn't disclose what percent of orders are delivery versus marketplace, you can back into the number knowing the take rates of the two pieces. Here you can see our backed into historical numbers as well as our projection for where things will go. So right about now, somewhere around 1/3 of orders are actually happening through delivery itself. Delivery is a key driver of take rate, so this is an important assumption in getting to a revenue projection. So with everything that we've been talking about, from the push to EBITDA parity, EBITDA per order parity in the delivery side of things, to the Yum partnership, to LevelUp, everything was going smoothly in the market on the heels of these actions. And the stock entered, was in a very bullish phase, but in the fall of 2018, things changed. The rollout of Yum started happening, the EBITDA per order started coming down, and the stock entered a prolonged second gutter period, that second bust phase. DoorDash is generally considered one of the biggest catalysts here. The company DoorDash started 2018 seemingly on the brink, but a series of four really large financings ever since and aggressive and strong execution from the company pulled them from a laggard to what some now consider the leader in the industry. DoorDash became one of the poster children of SoftBank's aggressive investments in cash burning startups with no mandate for profitability. And I got to tell you, I love having this little picture of Masa staring down on the DoorDash logo. DoorDash was able to use its blessing to burn cash in order to aggressively invest in customer acquisition. Every monthly market share report from the credit card and email panels at data aggregators started influencing the Grubhub stock as they were showing DoorDash increasingly taking share and perhaps exceeding Grubhub. But importantly, Grubhub's market share in its most important markets never really slipped too much. You could see that here, New York, Grubhub's like really main market, maintaining very, very high share, and DoorDash is not too significant there. This gets at an important reality of delivery. The network effects are not national in nature. What matters is the scale in a given region or municipality. There's a second important point here. Not all delivery markets are created equal. Some are way better than others. New York City is easily the best delivery market in the entire country, with far higher order values, much greater diner frequency. Marketplace as a percent of orders is much higher, so actual turnkey delivery is lower. Thus, profit and margin per person are much greater. And in other words, the LTV of each diner in New York is far greater than it is in any other city. And to add to those 2 points, market share itself is only half the story. First off, the actual market is growing rapidly, such that even in losing share, Grubhub's growth is incredibly impressive. Second, a lot of the incremental growth has been in Tier 2 and Tier 3 cities, where DoorDash actually had a first mover advantage over Grubhub. Core markets for Grubhub, where diner LTVs have been higher, have been very stable. So we showed you New York on the prior slide, there's Chicago as well, much of the Northeast. Those regions are far more suitable to delivery than are some of the more rural middle America regions. And that's where DoorDash has made most of its waves. Third, a lot of DoorDash's gross food sales that credit card panels pick up include non-partner restaurants. So unlike Grubhub, who develops a relationship with every single restaurant on its platform that it services, DoorDash will sell food from partners from restaurants who have no nexus to the company, so they're not partners. When an order comes in, someone at DoorDash places the order at the restaurant, a driver picks it up, and by the way, that driver has to pretend to be the person who placed that order and has to effectively lie to the restaurant that they're not a driver coming in to pick up on someone else's behalf. And the compensation to DoorDash from those orders comes from diner fees added on top of the actual menu prices, so significant markups here for the consumer, with no take rate. Many restaurants hate this for how they have no control over the quality of the experience, no visibility into who the diner is, and for diners themselves, the fees are really, you know, somewhat exorbitant. And then fourth, DoorDash has a deal with Walmart for last mile delivery that gets captured in gross food sales. So that's not even food. What it comes down to is you're effectively comparing apples to oranges when you look at things like national market share and total food sales. And one other point to make is that Grubhub is wildly profitable on all of its key unit economics, whether it be the each delivery itself or the average LTV of a diner, whereas DoorDash just is not. So in reality, the signs of competition are extrinsic, not intrinsic to the situation. And I say that because if you see this chart on the left, Grubhub's own metrics are doing just fine. You wouldn't even know they were facing a different competitive environment today than any point in their past public history. There's no sign of competition showing up yet in the pace of new diner ads, the churn amongst their diners, the order frequency of their diners, which, by the way, order frequency is trending lower, but that's because New York, as one of the first early markets, has really different frequency than do these new Tier 2 and Tier 3 cities. No signs of competition showing up in take rate or the growth trajectory of the marketplace or delivery itself. So the market is reacting to fears of DoorDash, but the fears aren't showing up anywhere. And that's because Grubhub really does have a differentiated offering. Grubhub is chugging along because the offering is unique. There's good evidence of this in Amazon shutting down. If you recall at the very beginning, I mentioned there were 2 days in which Grubhub went down 15% alone on Amazon's moves in the space. Meanwhile, here we are less than 2 years later, and Amazon is getting out of the business entirely. Clearly, capital alone is not enough to compete, nor is having a big trove of existing customers. I want to make the point that Grubhub's marketplace is the single most unique asset in the entire industry. The marketplace gives the company the mandate to focus on digitizing order flow instead of just being a commoditized logistics solution. At the end of the day, that's what turnkey delivery is. And then takeaway could eventually be as important as delivery itself. One other point I'd add to this on the marketplace is that its lush cash flows help finance delivery, so they don't need to take these aggressive financing from the SoftBanks of the world. So when people talk about this stock with dramatic headlines like the delivery wars, remember that only a portion of Grubhub's business today and in the future is delivery itself. And a lot of its addressable market exists in digitizing order flow. This idea of digitizing order flow allows Grubhub the opportunity to focus on lowering consumer-facing fees. You can see pretty clearly that Grubhub has the lowest fees of anyone in the industry, including the pizza companies like Domino's. And that's important because consumers are very sensitive to fees. And there are some surveys that really show this pretty clearly, that one of the biggest impediments to increasing consumer engagement are high costs, high fees. Another important source of differentiation is that the chains get all the attention and are an especially high percent of DoorDash's demand. But the fact is, the majority of the orders, the majority of the profit pool in this industry, it all exists in the incredibly fragmented long tail of independent restaurants. After all, most restaurants are these mom and pops, these independents. Grubhub is effectively outsourced marketing, technology, and in some cases, where they do the delivery, they're the logistics for the mom and pops. One thing Grubhub learned with the E24 acquisition, where promotional activity had been a big part of driving demand while it was under Yelp's ownership, is that promotions designed to induce orders are actually worthless or even a net negative to LTVs. They don't meaningfully change long-term behavior of any cohort of customers and instead just result in what management calls rented orders. That's a phrase you'll hear a lot from Grubhub management today. These rented orders push volume through and accomplish little else. When you're not at EBITDA or economic parity in a given region, there's some benefit on efficiency for the driver side of the network, but in any other situation, there's no point. As a result of these lessons from E24, Grubhub changed their promotional behavior across the entire platform to accommodate this reality. DoorDash happens to be the most promotional actor in the industry, so take that for what it's worth on the competition front. There's an extra point on DoorDash worth mentioning here. Their driver pay model is different than Grubhub's and arguably illegal in many jurisdictions. That's TBD, but I think we're going to find out soon enough. DoorDash effectively skims tips from drivers in order to support its unit economics. So when a DoorDash driver gets a tip on an order, DoorDash pays that driver less of what they're supposed to get out of the take rate or delivery fee. Were they forced to change this, and I think they will be, their unit economics would deteriorate meaningfully and their losses accelerate considerably. So burn, baby, burn on the cash front, DoorDash. Grubhub does not do this at all. A tip is a tip, and that's what the diner expects too. So I mentioned at the beginning that one of the benefits of being involved in a position long-term is how you can simplify a thesis. Given what I've just said about competition being extrinsic, not intrinsic, what do I think is the driving force here? I think the fact that the competition story emerged alongside management's expansion into new markets has caused some confusion. Management meaningfully took down EBITDA per order in order to facilitate the rollout to new markets. This made some investors nervous about whether it was competition or strategy driving profitability. But CFO Adam DeWitt has been very insistent that were growth not a priority, the company could earn $2 in EBITDA per order right now versus the approximately $1.30 to $1.35 they will realize this year. The fact is, the growth runway is so long that management is focusing on capturing the opportunity while staying disciplined and methodical about how that's pursued. And the core profitability shines through when you break down the numbers in more detail. So let's talk about valuation. Price to sales is one way I like to think about growth companies. I use this in my Roku presentation as well. This is about as cheap as Grubhub has been. Though importantly, the nature of price to sales has changed over time with the take rate differential we discussed on marketplace versus delivery orders. So I'm talking about the structurally lower margin in delivery that there is in marketplace. And that should have some effect on price to sales. So we could think about how to quantify that. One important thing I like to do with price to sales, which I showed in my Roku presentation, is how to think about out year implied margin and growth expectations. At roughly today's price to sales, either the margin expectation is way too low or the growth expectation is too low. If you assume 5% growth in perpetuity, you get a 20% net margin, which is within the range of where this company was, even in growth mode, and will be down the line. But the company is growing top line, and let's talk about normalized profitability in contrast to where they are with the delivery rollouts. So normalized profitability growth upwards of 20%, and they should be in the double digits for some time into the future. A second way I like thinking about valuation here is market cap to gross food sales. So the yellow line here is market cap, and the blue line is the 1 year forward gross food sales from history and then our estimates for 2019. It's my favorite valuation metric for this stock. In its public history, the numbers fluctuated around a 1-to-1 ratio. What's important is that the market cap to GFS captures the compositional shift from marketplace to delivery orders that price to sales does not capture. Effectively, EBITDA per order becomes the implied margin here. The 1-to-1 ratio has persisted while EBITDA to GFS has hovered around 4.5%. The period where the yellow line went above the blue line for a decent stretch of time happened when profitability stepped above that 4.5% level. In essence, the stock's value should grow roughly in line with the growth in gross food sales. GFS grew 34% last year. We expect about 27% growth in GFS this year. And over the next 5 years, we expect GFS to compound at about 18.3% with room for upside. If you think about 18.3% as an expected IRR on the stock, that's not a bad return, not a bad return in any investment situation. So I mentioned before that EBITDA per order has been under pressure, but we expect that to recover as the $40 million in delivery market expansion expense rolls off and new markets get more efficient. Further, we think this will naturally trend towards the $2 EBITDA per order DeWitt says he can get tomorrow and beyond as the company resumes demonstrating how much scalability and margin leverage there is in the cost structure. S&M, which is their customer acquisition cost, is one of the biggest sources of operating leverage. And as S&M, as a percent of revenues, declines, albeit under continued growth invested into acquiring diners. So we're not saying the absolute value of expenditure on S&M is going to decline only as a percent of revenues. The company should be able to get to a 7% EBITDA to GFS margin down the line when you get closer to maturity. So here are the operations and support assumptions. These are the way you go about showing what the delivery versus marketplace margin should look like, so you can get a sense for when and where we expect total efficiency on the delivery side, where the cost structure fits into that 15% part. A big lever on the delivery side in particular comes in the form of average order value. The cost per drop, as they say in the industry, the cost for a delivery itself, is relatively fixed. So that high order value multiplied by the take rate flows through pretty purely to the bottom line. At the bottom, you can see our DCF values and the important KPI assumptions in getting there. So we have gross food sales, revenue, S&M as a percent of revenue, EBITDA to GFS, and the price per share that the DCF would spit out at the various assumptions. And one of the important things is, given the really long runway the company's growing into, there's a good chance that the actuality of a terminal value here is pushed out. And each incremental year, every year you add to this, adds meaningful value. So one thing I always like asking is, how would I know if we're wrong? There are two key ways I think that would play out. First is the competition angle. If we see signs that there is increased churn in early cohorts, that would show up in a big slowdown in the pace of net new diner ads, alongside consistently high spend on S&M. So if new diner ads slow because S&M comes down, that's okay, right? They're telling us they can't really acquire diners. That might have consequences for growth, but it doesn't mean that the early cohorts are churning off. The way I think about it is realistically for a competitor to induce churn in Grubb's customer base, what they would have to do is meaningfully reduce a friction, so make the process much, much simpler, or offer lower costs, right? Lower consumer-facing costs. And that's just not happening anywhere. In fact, Grubhub's the lowest cost for consumers that you get in the industry. Second, this could be wrong if management continues to burn margin on new delivery markets without ever reaching economic parity. This would show there's something fundamentally wrong with the delivery market and that management isn't quite as disciplined as they have been historically. What gives us comfort is that so far there's no evidence of the former and no reason to believe management will pursue the latter. They've been highly disciplined, highly rational. One of the ways in which you see this most is on the M&A front. They haven't paid high valuations that exist in the startup space. They've bought good assets at good prices at low implied values per diner, E24 being a good example of this. So see no reason to believe why that would happen. And then one of the things I like doing is reasoning by analogy. And I think a great analogy here is Booking, or the company formerly known as Priceline. In a lot of ways, the rise of online ordering for food has a parallel to the rise of OTAs. And from my seat, Grubb looks a lot like Booking, while DoorDash looks a lot like Expedia. Sure, Expedia in aggregate does more gross bookings than Booking itself, but Booking is drastically more profitable because of superior business model. They have the agency model, contrasting to Expedia's merchant model. The key part of the analogy is that Booking deals with the really fragmented European hotel landscape, while Expedia deals primarily with the large US chains. The economics of a marketplace are inherently inferior when catering to chains and hotels, because the chains become a consolidated source of supply and have a lot more leverage over the platform. And it will be no different in delivery. The chains get a lot of attention in the delivery headlines, but independent restaurants make up the vast majority of Grubhub demand, much like small hotels do for Booking. One important difference in Grubhub's favor, in contrast to Booking, is that in delivery, the order flow from search and discovery all the way through begins in-app. So it's Grubhub who owns the customer, whereas with Booking, while the company is trying to change that today with their new strategy, spending less on Google, search and discovery still begins primarily at Google in the OTA space. So they're one step down the funnel, and that's hard. That means there's some more margin that goes to different areas. With Grubhub, they are the starting point for their 20 million active diners. So just for comparison's sake, Grubhub today is at Booking's 2006 revenue run rate. Booking has compounded top line at 24% over these last 12 years. If you remember from our DCF how each year of terminal value extension adds significant value to Grubhub, then you could get a good appreciation for why this investment opportunity is so exciting today. Doesn't necessarily, not here to suggest that Grubhub's gonna compound at 24%, but they could fall decently short of that number and end up with an outstanding investment return for us from this seat. So long story short, love Grubhub as a growth at a reasonable price investment with a wide moat, differentiated offering in a large growing addressable market. So thank you, John, for having me, and would love any questions if you got them.
Terrific. Well, thank you, Elliot, for another fascinating presentation. Just a reminder to everyone on the line, if you do have a question, feel free to type it into the online interface. There's a question I'm showing, and you did kind of address this talking about the risks, but I'll pose it to you anyway. You mentioned that delivery is a local economies of scale game. combined with the notion that the internet trends toward winner takes all, does that mean the future is Grubhub winning the really profitable delivery networks? And if that's the case, do they then subsidize the less desirable markets to win those as well, or do they optimize for profitability?
Yeah, you know, I think it, to an extent, it's a little bit of a winner take all in a given region, or really like a Pareto distribution. So New York's tipping towards like what looks like an 80-20 balance from Seamless Web and Grubhub in the lead to everyone else. In aggregate, I don't think it's going to be winner take all on a national level. And I think there will always be a reason for other offerings to exist in a given market, whether like someone like Caviar with a boutique offering of really high end, or just for the fact that some restaurants, especially chains, will want levers to pull in order to try to get better take rates for themselves. It'll be hard for anyone to win literally everything. And further, I think there will be consolidation in the industry. So Grubhub has been a consolidator. They've made over a dozen acquisitions in their history. You know, really, with Grubhub and the Seamless merger being a pretty big one. But I do think there's a big opportunity to consolidate. And to that end, I think Grubhub is actually one of the more attractive, is attractive on both sides of it, both as a consolidator who could profitably roll up and add in offerings, and as an acquisition target. So I think someone like, you know, I gave you the Booking and Expedia example as an analogy. One of the interesting things to think about is who Expedia's CEO was in the early phase of the OTA launch when they were really, not launch, of the OTA industry, when they really were also rolling up and kind of figuring out what offerings worked in the market and scaling towards two main platforms. It was the CEO, Dara Khosrowshahi, of Uber today. And Dara has said that he sees the potential for Uber Eats to be addressing a bigger market than Uber's taxi offering itself. And I think Dara has reflected in some context on the mistake of having not bought Booking when Priceline did. Expedia had an opportunity and they just didn't appreciate at the time the agency model. And I think Dara would recognize that in something like Grubhub, there's a major opportunity to integrate the first party and third party offering. So if they get the marketplace, integrate that in Uber Eats, he's got a lot more cash flow to subsidize their launch into other places, into other geographies, and to maintain some less profitable markets. And I think one sign that that's something that they may be thinking about, obviously this is like very you know, speculative in a sense, but in London, Uber started doing a marketplace offering. So like it would be a lot harder for them to get into that in the US than it would there. But yeah, so I don't think there will be a winner take all, but I do think there will be natural impetuses for consolidation as a lot more of the market moves online and as the push to synergies lead to more profitability rather than growth itself being the primary driver. That's how I think about it.
What do you
And you know what? I'd add one more thing. Amazon, you know, they left the London marketplace in the fall of last year. And they just acquired their way back into the UK with Deliveroo. I think it's very possible. And look at Amazon, right? They also like running the first party, third party marketplace. Look at what they're doing with their actual, you know, goods. It's very possible that something like Grubhub is appealing to them because they recognize the need to get into last mile as well, and it would be a good way to do it. So just an idea.
What do you make of the argument that independent mom and pop restaurants may lose market share over time when to these startup kitchens being set up, let's say, outside of a downtown area and being solely focused on delivery? And would those use a platform like Grubhub, or would they try to go direct?
Yeah, that's a great question. So cloud kitchens are getting a lot of interest, right? So Travis Kalanick, founder of Uber, he said cloud kitchens are his next project, and he's been working on that space. And one interesting digression, Bill Gurley was at Benchmark, was the VC who invested in Grubhub, had a board seat, and he went into Uber early, had a board seat, and you know they went into Eats. And so just taking it back to the cloud kitchen question, right? You have these platforms. One of the ways to get efficiencies on the delivery side of things is to do what's called batching orders. So, right, let's say an order is placed with a restaurant. The driver goes to that restaurant, picks up an order, and takes it straight to the diner. That's slightly less efficient than if a driver could go to one restaurant, pick up five orders, and then go to five different houses. And cloud kitchens make a much cleaner opportunity to batch orders. Munchery was a startup in New York City that tried being a cloud kitchen that did its own delivery. And the model just didn't work because there were it's really expensive to run a delivery network, and just having a lot of offerings from one kitchen wasn't enough. You have to have a lot of diners who are interested in your offering, and you have to have a lot of supply on the restaurant side. So you need depth on both sides of the marketplace. But I do think that cloud kitchens are going to proliferate a lot more because of these delivery offerings in given markets. And one approach that Grubhub's taken, in the past they had invested in some of these and they still have those. They're kind of de minimis. Deliveroo in London has invested in them pretty intently. But one of the things that Grubhub does is they use data to figure out which markets are missing an offering that the cohorts of diners tend to like. So they could look at diner behavior and say, in this market, people who like this pizzeria and that Chinese restaurant and that Italian restaurant would actually like an Indian offering. And they're able to tell the restaurants in that region, look, there's an opportunity here. And the restaurants themselves could use their back of house and create some sort of second restaurant out of the same address, where they don't necessarily have that second restaurant out of the front, but they're able to batch orders that way as well. So long story short, I do think that cloud kitchens are going to play a big role in this industry, but I view the platforms as like the grease for the wheels for those to exist. I don't think they're competitive. I think they actually play greatly into the advantages of the platforms.
There's a question just asking for more data or whether that's available, such as what the marketplace market share is, also versus delivery alone and in various local markets or nationally.
Yeah, so the marketplace market share. The marketplace still today is the biggest part, and I'm trying to find the slide, if you'll bear with me for a second. The marketplace is the biggest part of the offering. So about a third of the orders go through delivery itself. And the thing is, long run, and it's especially because of the compositional shift from these tier one cities like New York and Chicago to tier two and three cities. So the market's going to be a lot bigger in different places that we expect delivery to start taking more share. But I think you could effectively back into it because using this credit card data, you could get aggregate market shares. So there's $20 billion flowing through the delivery platforms. You have two-thirds of Grubhub's gross food sales flowing through marketplace. So divide that number out by the $20 billion on-platform TAM, and you'd have a share that's marketplace. And the marketplace itself, I think it's important to point out, while the share that's going across marketplace is decreasing in Grubhub's business, marketplace itself continues to grow at a nice rate. So I think there will always be a place for it long term. I think there's some more restaurants realizing that as their delivery business does better and better, that they have some margin to capture by having their own delivery offering. So I do think as this market shakes out, you will see a second wave where marketplace kind of recoups some share total from delivery, not embedding that into any assumptions longer term. But I think marketplace will play a really important role and it has the best economics long term. So I could get back to you on an actual number and multiply it out, but it's definitely accessible.
A question on the competition from DoorDash. You spent a lot of time and articulated quite well the advantage of Grubhub, but it does sound like the competition could be perhaps called irrational in the sense that DoorDash is losing money to try to gain market share, and that never seems to be a great market space to be in. With such irrational competition, how do you see this playing out longer term? Is there a scenario for DoorDash to do well and for Grubhub to do well, i.e., with both making money?
Yeah, the market could stay irrational longer than you could stay solvent, right? So there could always be follow-on cash behind the irrational cash. But to an extent, there is a rationale behind it, which is that this opportunity is massive. So to that end, I do think there's room for both DoorDash and Grubhub to succeed. And I do think they're solving different problems. So DoorDash is solving last mile logistics. Grubhub is digitizing orders. And there are different ways that that's going to play out over the long run. And I do think that, look at Uber IPOing now. SoftBank's in both Uber and DoorDash, incidentally. But as you go public, the market gets increasingly focused on what you can do from a bottom-line basis. And DoorDash investors are going to want a return on their investment at some point. And that involves an IPO. So at the end of the day, I think what really gives me comfort more than anything else, though, is that Grubhub's core markets, despite this influx of cash, remain as profitable as they ever have. They continue to grow. Diner behavior continues to be consistent. So I think it gets at that point I was making about how in order to induce churn in those existing cohorts, cash alone is not enough. Irrationality doesn't change what a solution that really works comfortably, seamlessly, and consistently for diners. So I still think it's mostly around the edges, and I do think there'll be room for them both to succeed. And I think it gets back at that general idea that this is a local business, it's not a national business. So no matter what you do in any in, what works in one geography won't necessarily work in another one.
Terrific, Elliot. Well, we will leave it there. Thank you very much for taking the time to be with us again and to share such an interesting and well-researched thesis with our members. We truly appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me once again. Love this conference every year. So look forward to going through some of the rest of the presentations. Have a
Terrific.
great
And
weekend.
thank you. And to all of you on the line, thanks for being with us. Please join us for our next live session at 4 p.m. Eastern with Chris Carlin. Until then, goodbye.